Hello and welcome to the American Magazine podcast for the week of November 21st. And we're doing another of our monthly editors roundtables. And today we're joined by Karen Sue Smith, editorial director, and Father Raymond Troth, associate editor. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much. We're glad to be here.
Now we're going to start with Father Ray because we have the most timely topic that you've brought to us, which is the question of the crisis in Syria, which is the news is changing by the day. Looks like there's a danger of civil war perhaps breaking out. But Father Ray, maybe you could bring us, introduce to us this special on Frontline, which you reviewed in the magazine just this week.
I like to write about places where I have some experience. I'm not necessarily an expert on them, but I've been to several of these countries that are part of the Arab Spring in different time parts of my life. I've been to Tunisia when I was in college, and then in the about 10 or 15 years ago, I went to Syria with a group. Interested in how they might respond, each one in its different way. I'd also been to Egypt a few years before that. So there's a connection between what's happening to these various countries in the Middle East, and I think the wrong metaphor for it is the bowling alley thing. So as if each bowling alley is a different country, and then you take that bowling alley, that ball, and you roll it down or a whammo, that's one country down. Next, and next, because they're quite different, and Syria is different in different ways. One is so beautifully old, because it's thousands and thousands of years old. They trace themselves back to King David. The same thing is in Damascus. Damascus is very prominent in the New Testament, particularly in the Acts of the Apostles. And when I was there in 93, we went down the street called Straight, where Paul went and had his blindness cured. And I see that window up there. That's the one he escaped from when his enemies were trying to get him. So with my group, we had an interview with a local bishop of the Eastern Church. And both there and in Iraq, which I'd also visited some years after that, under these dictatorial regimes, the church and diverse groups had a lot of freedom. And they were content with their living relationship with the regime. So I was hoping, I would hate to see Syria lose that. Iraq is beginning to lose it, and maybe some of the other countries are as well. Now, the other thing is the various solutions that are attempted to be offered in each of the countries, and a couple of them, let's say in Tunisia and Egypt, to some degree, it was truly a democratic uprising from the bottom. And all of them, what they have in common is dictators. And so movement from below removes the dictator. But in the same method will not apply in each case. And Syria is the most, say, tough and stable at the top of all of these countries. Libya was basically a mess so far as constitution or laws or customs or institutions. And so their revolution was very chaotic. And it was resolved in a brutal and in some ways immoral matter, at least in the lynching of their leader.
Yes, and I think that's a good point. And something that certainly I brought out of the documentary is that this is not Egypt. There is no Tahrir Square. That movement, that in fact Damascus is very different from some of these other cities.
Right.
And that's why it's looking more like civil war than necessarily, you know, this groundswell from the whole population.
Yeah. Well, a civil war also implies two sides. And the opposition is nowhere near as well organized or as large in Syria as it was in Libya. And they're very short. Nor are they going to get the international support that they did. Libya was successful because From one opinion I read that the UN went beyond its, how to say, charter or agreement or arrangement or law, and they not only we claimed that we were going in there with our planes, flyovers, to protect the lives of innocent civilians. We did much more than that. We joined the battle, and in the extent of our bombing, I'm sure we killed a lot of civilians at the same time.
Karen, maybe you can introduce the piece of the documentary with this reporter who got into Syria, which that's part of the problem here. We're not getting a lot of reporting from Syria at this point.
Well, the first thing I thought about her was how brave she was as a reporter. Here's this young woman with a headscarf, and she's all the shots show you in the back of a car, stealing in the dead of night, usually, yeah, with these lights on, and she's telling you, sometimes in a whisper, what's happening, and she's going to see various people who have died, yeah, the sites, the big, huge blood stain of a child who was killed.
Yeah.
She talks to parents and several fathers or whatever who had lost their sons. Mm-hmm. And in the whole thing is this hushed atmosphere, and then there's this episode where they're waiting for the troops to come in and get them.
Yeah.
And they're right next door, and you can hear the people there, and then they show you what happened. And the other big thing that you notice is how secretive they have to be, so that when they show you all these crowd scenes and interview people right up close, they can't show you anyone's face.
Yeah.
And they do that, I don't know what you call it, where they smudge the faces in the crowd so, yeah, that you can't see anyone. And so you realize that they're not kidding when they say martyrs and when they talk about sacrifice.
Yeah. And you see the passion of these people who... they want change, and they're willing to risk their lives for it. And, you know, there was one moving scene where you had I think it was a young boy who said, you know, once I'm able to, I'm going back to the protest. So while they may not be as organized, as you said, Ray, they do certainly seem to be very passionate. Why don't we transition here, to an essay that I've brought to the table by the New Yorker contributor George Packer, called The Broken Contract, Inequality and American Decline. Inequality, I mean, that's an issue that came up in the Syria documentary. That's one of the issues, is that there's this wealthy class that's kind of holding on to power, and there's these poor, this poor class, which is not getting the attention they deserve, and that's one of the reasons they're rising up. Let me just read a couple quotes from this, and then maybe we can have a discussion, just about what inequality can do to a society. Inequality divides us from one another in schools, in neighborhoods, at work, on airplanes, in hospitals, in what we eat, in the condition of our bodies, in what we think, in our children's futures, in how we die. Inequality makes it harder to imagine the lives of others, which is one reason why the fate of over 14 million more or less permanently unemployed Americans leaves so little impression in the country's political and media capitals. This is a topic that's been written about a lot, inequality, but I felt there was some real urgency in the way he wrote this. Karen, maybe you can jump in.
I think one of the powerful things in that particular piece was how he goes back to the year 1978.
Yeah.
And he shows you the contrast in the previous decades, how wealth was distributed more fairly. There still were wealthy people and poor people in the United States, but it was different. The wealthy people used to have a kind of an expectation that they were the caretakers of this. There was a social contract, and they were the caretakers of the poor. It was their responsibility to act in certain ways. And these aren't just philanthropists, they're business people and leaders who feel they have excess and so they can leave a legacy. And he contrasts it with what's happened since 1978, which is the beginning of the Reagan Revolution, really, where the social contract has been broken. And it wasn't just broken accidentally. And that's the thing, that it's not that he has a conspiracy theory, it's that there have been groups of people who have an ideology that says, we better break this. And they've done all kinds of things through the law, through legal means and through Congress, et cetera, to break it. And they have actually broken it. And then I found the end pretty much dismal and hopeless, because the author doesn't come up with any solutions at all. Not even that we might have some young people that have the same kind of commitment that those young Arabs have, and the young people in Syria, for example, and other places.
One of the aspects of this, which has been written about, and he touches on it, but I think not as much, is the extent to which this was sort of an intellectual coup engineered with a lot of corporate support at the same time as the Reagan administration was coming into power. And what conservatives have in common is that it's easier to get them all thinking in the same box, where every liberals will always say, well, wait a minute, I understand your basic principle, but I've got a lot more interesting, complex suggestion on this, and I'm not going to go that far, and you're probably going to go farther than that. There's no such thing as 10 liberals in the same room all saying the same thing, whereas the conservatives are much more centered on what they can agree on some basic slogans. And they did it by some would be called nonprofits, or they would be called institutes of
think tanks
for the preservation of something or other. And then they hire big bucks to get scholars and put them on board, and make them rich by saying, reading the Bible, namely the conservative Bible.
Right? Yeah, no, I think there's definitely, that's a big part of the story. Yeah. I will mention that Packer does also fault the Democrats for taking money from Wall Street, and, you know, points to Charles Schumer, for example, who has been a big defender of those interests, because, you know, as Bob Dole once said, he quotes here, poor people don't make campaign contributions. Yeah. So it's unfortunately both sides have been affected. Again, that 1978 comparison, as you said, Karen, is very telling, because he lists all the things we have today that we didn't have back then, and saying nobody would want to go back to that time where you didn't have iPhones and you didn't have access to all these great medical breakthroughs and such. Yeah. And yet, it turns out society much less equal than it was then. So there's this, it's kind of perverse when you think about it.
It's not even just inequality, though. He has, I think, three or four signs of the breakage of this contract, and I can't remember what they all are. I wish I had my marked up copy here, but one of them has to do with seeking your own good even at the expense of the national good. In other words, it's a kind of thing, if my company can put off cleaning up my oil spill until, you know, 40 years from now they'll find out that we didn't do a good job, who cares, because 40 years from now I won't be held accountable for it. And so there's a way that's my interest I place above, and my interest can be individual or personal with my own wealth, or they can be with my company, or they can be with my office that I want to maintain because it has perks for me. And so there's a certain kind of atomization that's happened where people don't, even people in the elite leadership categories, don't look out for each other. That was one, at least, of those several signs.
The other aspect of this is you really can't participate in politics anymore unless you're super rich. You cannot run for office unless you've got many $1 million used to be a lot of money.
Right.
Not anymore.
Well, I should mention this essay is in Foreign Affairs. I don't think I said that.
Yeah.
In November, December 2001, so that's the current issue. I don't think this is available online, but if you want to, I'm sure I'd be happy if you wanted to purchase this issue. It's worthwhile. This is part of a general topic that they've taken on the question of American decline. Is America over? That's the question they pose. This is a good transition, Karen, to the essay that you have in the current issue, Your Of Many Things. When you face a problem like inequality, and as you say at the end, Packer doesn't come up with a lot of solutions, and it's kind of almost hopeless at the end, what can an individual do? And here you can introduce Leonard Wolf, who you write about.
Yes, I wrote about Leonard Wolf. It was a book I picked up. I didn't really know anything about him. It's the first biography that's ever been written of Leonard Wolf, and most people will not even recognize his name. But Leonard Wolf is the husband of Virginia Wolf, who, when he was married to her, probably had no idea that she would become one of the most important British writers of literature in the 20th century. But in any case, Leonard Wolf got a good review, and I decided to pick up this book, and I'm so glad I did, because what I found was a person who I didn't know. I was introduced to him. He's, of course, part of this whole Bloomsbury group, which has interested me for a long, long time. And Leonard is a Londoner from way back. His family was part of a Jewish community that built up in London, and his father was a solicitor, and he's from the Kensington area, which where I have lived in London myself. And he started out as one of nine children, living a, they call it a middle-class life, but actually it was a very privileged life. He wasn't a Rothschild or anything, but it was the group underneath of professionals. And everything seemed to be going swimmingly. Leonard used to write a little newspaper when he was about seven of events in his family, that kind of thing. And the next thing you know, when he's 11, his father dies. And that was one of those things then. They didn't really have a social safety net. They weren't the socialist country they are now. And so when that happened, his mother was not able to maintain their lifestyle at all. They had to move way out to Putney. And they moved away from an area which was the area where Vanessa Stevens and her father and her sister, Virginia Stevens, lived, and where Clive Bell lived, and where the Strakeys lived. And some anybody who knows about Bloomsbury will recognize some of these names. I don't know where Keynes lived or some of the others, Duncan Grant. But this whole group of people, they all turn out to be lifelong friends, and some of them closer than friends. but in any case, here's this young boy who is smart, very small, and but competitive in sports and every which thing. And he wins a scholarship to St. Paul's School, which is the same school that G.K. Chesterton went to. And it's where they pretty much harassed and abused the Jewish scholarship students, which is pretty sad. But in any case, he didn't notice it. He was involved in all of his studies. And the next thing you know, he's got himself into Trinity College in Cambridge. And so he's done well for himself. But then the next thing that happens is he doesn't graduate at the top of his class. And so when he leaves there, he has no money. He doesn't know what he's going to do with his life or whatever. And he goes into what was at that time what was considered a good job, which was colonial service. And he ends up in Ceylon, which we know as Sri Lanka. So it's this island at the bottom of India, I think is where it is. And it's his first taste of anything outside London life. But he's an omnivore of all things. And he takes it in, and he takes in the whole system. And while he starts out being a judge, at the end of just several years, he's very, very good at this, and he's a just judge. And this is one of the things that interested me was, even though he wasn't brought up religious, his father gave him the rudiment of his faith, and he never forgot it. In fact, he embodied it. And that was that verse from Micah where it says, act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. And when you look at the very end of Leonard Wolfe's life, you'll see that he pretty much did that, even though he could be pretty cantankerous and all sorts of other things. By the end of his time in Ceylon, he's become an anti-imperialist, and he goes back to London on leave, falls in love with Virginia Stevens. She becomes Virginia Wolfe, and they set up this life, which you would think might be pretty grand. But in actual fact, it was one giant slog.
Right, Karen, you pick up a couple interesting things in your essay that maybe we can draw out here. One is that the support he gave to Virginia, the fact that he was pretty selfless at a time when, men were not being known for supporting their wives' careers. Here was somebody who was kind of nursing her through these mental illness, which he had. You know, she eventually took her own life, and he was a real support to her.
He didn't realize when he fell in love with her what the extent of her depression was, or that her own father had suffered from depression. It actually runs through his family as well. And later in life, when his brothers and some of his brothers and sisters are quite old, two of them also commit suicide. So he's surrounded by a difficult, anxious set of people. But Virginia was a very delicate case and a very delicate person, and he just loved her. And he knew how to love. And so to me, this is like, if you have anything you can learn in your life, you need to know how to work and how to love. If you can do those two things, it almost doesn't matter the rest. He also had enormous friends. He was just, and so he found himself as an arbiter constantly. He felt that Virginia had reclusive tendencies, and so he, in some ways, built up a community around her. He was a gardener, always, since the time he was a child, and he created a kind of garden existence for her. And so I think in some ways he not only encouraged all of her writing, he published it, and he actually, I mentioned this in the piece, for 28 years he lives way after her. His Hogarth Press almost pretty much manufactures the whole Bloomsbury group, all their writing, who they were, their biography, their letters. He collects all this stuff, and so a whole lot of what we know about Virginia Woolf comes from Leonard. Yeah, the other thing about Friends, E.M. Forster was one of the members of this group, the Bloomsbury group, and you forget who he is half the time when you're reading about this because they call him Morgan, and nobody knows him as Morgan.
Right.
But anyway, Morgan Forster has said that he would never have written A Passage to India if it hadn't been for the encouragement of Leonard Woolf. That's the kind of thing.
Right, so there are these people in history who you may not know of, or they may not be as famous as their friends, but they were crucial to their success. And also, as we, you know, maybe we can end by looking at this question of, he looked back at the end of his life and felt like, did I have any effect? Did what I did working against these issues? And sometimes, he was frustrated. He wasn't sure if it did, but yet he still worked at it.
Well, we didn't say exactly what the big issues were that he worked on, and I just wanted to say he lived through World War I, World War II. He was a Jew during these wars. He personally watched Britain be bombed to smithereens in London and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, he was right in the thick of it. He was an early Labour Party, I don't know what you call it, a proponent. And his big claim to fame, in a way, aside from writings on international government and writings on all kinds of other things, including silly, funny writings and all, but was the League of Nations. And even that, of course, he watched that crumble, too.
Right.
And so in the end, he decided he couldn't say that his life had amounted to all kinds of swimming successes. And in fact, he didn't think it had. But the thing I love him for, and I'll probably read this book again, actually, just because I love reading books over and over until I kind of get it. But the thing I love him for is that he basically said he couldn't have done otherwise. He couldn't live among all this intolerance and injustice and just do nothing. So he had to do something. And so he's the exact opposite of one of those points that George Packer made, where people began to think only of themselves and not the good of society. He was exactly the opposite. He knew how to love, and he knew how to love the people close to him, and he knew how to love what was right.
Yes, in your phrase, I guess this is from the biography, the habit of loving and how to engender that. Yeah. Well, I think we'll end on that, but I want to thank you both for taking part in this conversation.
Thank you.